Good morning. On today's programme, the tactics used by Brazil's president to hold on to power and remembering the victims of the Beirut port blast 2 years on. But first to the visit by US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan this week, which sparked a furious response from China. Beijing sent warplanes and missiles into Taiwan's territorial waters, suspended cooperation deals with the United States, and issued a slew of sanctions against Taiwanese businesses. The tension was a stark reminder that the US and China rivalry is rapidly growing and the balance of power is changing, leaving Taiwan, a democratic, self-ruling island nation of 23 million people, stuck in the middle. This report from Yvonne Murray, who spent the last number of years reporting for RTE from China and Taiwan.
Soon after we arrived in Taiwan last year, my daughter was surrounded in the playground at her new Taipei school by a group of curious children. But their first question wasn't, who's your favourite pop singer or do you like Pokemon? These kids wanted to know, did she think Taiwan was part of China? It was a big geopolitical question for a 10-year-old to ponder, and somewhat confusing, given that only weeks before in her Beijing school, her Chinese teachers would often refer to Taiwan as part of China. But here, her new friends suggested that no would be the correct answer to their question. It was an insight into the growing chasm between Chinese and Taiwanese attitudes to unification, and how generations of young Taiwanese are growing up with a very separate identity, and therefore no desire to be forcibly unified with China. Indeed, the more autocratic the People's Republic of China becomes, the less most Taiwanese citizens, especially the young, want anything to do with it. This is an infuriating problem for the Chinese leadership. They know that the chances of peaceful acquisition of Taiwan are next to nil, which leaves coercion and possibly even military conflict as the only options. This week, China's ambassador to France gave us a glimpse into how they might bring a reluctant Taiwanese population to heel once they took control of the island. We will re-educate them, he told a French TV channel. I'm sure, he said, that after re-education, they'll become favourable to reunification and become patriotic. China has been condemned by human rights groups over its existing re-education policies deployed to brutal effect in Xinjiang, Tibet and Hong Kong, for the same reason, to instill devotion to the Communist Party among people suspected of disloyalty. Most Taiwanese are all too aware of China's intentions, and indeed some people you meet in Taiwan see it as an inevitability that is futile to resist, favouring peaceful acquiescence instead. Others, though, are already preparing to resist, and this year, following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, signed up in greater numbers for firearms training courses. But what China's reaction to Nancy Pelosi's visit shows is that a full-scale invasion and occupation, and no doubt Taiwanese counterinsurgency, is just one potential scenario. The Chinese regime has many other tools at its disposal, and this week, for the first time, showed its willingness to use them. The PLA's implementation of a de facto blockade of the island, caused by the ongoing military exercises, for example, sent shivers down already pandemic-disrupted global supply chains. Cargo ships bound for Europe and America hurriedly found new routes to avoid Chinese live fire. Let's not forget that much of the world's cutting-edge technology relies on computer chips made in Taiwan and shipped from the island along these international sea lanes. China already claims the Taiwan Strait, deemed international waters under a UN convention, as its own. With the temperature rising, how long will other countries preserve freedom of navigation through this key trade route without having to ask China's permission? But China also has diplomatic and economic cards to play. Officials walked out of talks with Japan this week, ditched cooperation agreements with the US on climate change, drummed up support from dozens of other countries at the UN for its position, and put the squeezes on Taiwanese and American businesses in China. While some commentators breathed a sigh of relief that these measures were at least well short of a declaration of war, they were, nevertheless, an indication of how much more powerful and more confident China is today than the last time tension over Taiwan turned into a crisis in the mid-1990s. But this is also a good opportunity for Beijing to test the resolve of other powers in the Indo-Pacific. Is the US, Japan, and even Australia really willing to come to Taiwan's defence? To what extent will they defend their interests and the current balance of power in the wider region? China is watching closely. As for the children in my daughter's Taipei playground, they're growing up in the shadow of an authoritarian superpower that has vowed to take over by force. But their lives aren't defined by it. Long hours studying at the after-school clubs are more of a daily concern than ballistic missile tests off the coast. Because none of this is new for people in Taiwan. The only surprise to them is when the outside world chooses to take notice. I'm Yvonne Murray for World Report.
Next, we go to Brazil, and with 2 months to go until the presidential elections there, two-time former president and union leader Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva continues to lead the polls over far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. President Bolsonaro is doing his best to hold on to power, however, including by upping welfare payments for Brazil's poorest. And if that doesn't work, many analysts fear an increase in political violence. From Sao Paulo, Sam Cowie reports.
Across Brazil, street vendors have been conducting their own official polling for Brazil's upcoming presidential elections. On Paulista Avenue, Sao Paulo's main thoroughfare, and in Rio de Janeiro's city centre, hawkers are selling towels emblazoned with the faces of the two frontrunners, far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro and leftist former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The street sellers are keeping score of how many towels they have sold, marking each sale on a blackboard. Currently, two unofficial counts put Lula ahead by double-digit margins. "Come and help change the score. Poor Bolsonaro, my God, someone help him, please," joked one vendor in Sao Paulo whose placard gave Lula 51 towel sales and Bolsonaro 12. The video was published by local news site Metropolis. Brazilian social media users have nicknamed the phenomena Data Toalha, or Data Towel, a play on Brazil's most respected polling agency, Data Folha. 2 months until the October 2nd election first round, Data Folha's official polling also puts Lula ahead by a double-digit margin. Latest polls suggested that former union leader Lula held an 18-point lead over ex-army captain Bolsonaro in the first round, with 47% of voters choosing the two-time former president over the incumbent. If that lead increases any further, it is possible that Lula could take the election in the first round without the need for a runoff. Analysts expect the lead to narrow, however. On August the 9th, Bolsonaro's government will increase welfare payments to Brazil's poor by 50% until the end of the year. Other benefits, such as subsidies on household cooking gas and on fuel for truckers and taxi drivers, as well as gasoline price cuts, will come into effect in the next 30 days. Critics have blasted the measures as cynical and opportunist, while at the same time, many politicians running for re-election have been forced to swallow them for fear of losing votes themselves. With some 33 million Brazilians going hungry, according to latest studies, against a backdrop of roaring inflation and rocketing living costs, no politician can be perceived opposed to putting money in poor people's pockets. "The expansion of benefits is an electoral, populist measure that cannot be sustained," said André Janones, a congressman for Minas Gerais state and himself a presidential candidate, polling in single digits. "It is a disguised purchase of votes, but there was no climate, possibility or conditions for me or any other lawmaker to vote against it," he continued. Janones told local media that he was considering axing his candidacy to support Lula in the first round. Meanwhile, analysts at the Eurasia Group, which is considered the world's top political risk consultancy, say that the government benefit increases will have little practical effect and that Bolsonaro's rejection rates will remain high. Fears of electoral violence, however, are widespread. Earlier in July, Marcelo Arruda, a municipal guard and political activist of Lula's Workers' Party, was shot dead by a Bolsonaro supporter at his 50th birthday party in the city of Foz do Iguaçu, on Brazil's border with Paraguay and Argentina. The killer, a prison guard named Jorge José Guaranho, arrived at Arruda's Lula-themed birthday party, shouting pro-Bolsonaro chants and making threats. The pair had a brief altercation, after which Guaranho returned with a gun and opened fire. Arruda, also armed, returned fire. Both were hospitalized, but Arruda later died of his injuries. Most analysts think it highly unlikely the possibility of a traditional tanks on the street coup, like the one that happened in Brazil in 1964 and ushered in 21 years of military dictatorship. However, President Bolsonaro continues to sow doubt on Brazil's electronic voting system, raising long-held suspicions that he is paving the way to contest the elections. If that's the case, many fear that a Capitol Hill January 6th-style uprising by his most radical supporters could be a possibility, with even more violence. The next test will be Brazil's 200th Independence Day on September 7th, when the president has called on his supporters to fill the streets. For World Report in Sao Paulo, I'm Sam Cowie.
Finally, we go to Lebanon and Beirut, where this week hundreds of people gathered to mark the second anniversary of the port explosion, which killed over 200 people and injured more than 7,000 others. The blast left 300,000 people homeless and destroyed a large chunk of the city. And as Hannah McCarthy reports from Beirut, the people there are divided over how best to remember those who lost their lives.
The pink sky above Beirut port was mixed with grey smoke, coming from the tall grain silos that pierced the skyline. After being badly damaged in the port explosion 2 years ago, the silos were now burning. Rotting wheat inside the tall cement structures had caught fire in the summer heat, and local firefighters hadn't been able to put the fires out for weeks. I watched the silos from the Charles Hello Highway that separates the port from the residential neighbourhoods that lie just a few hundred feet away. These areas bore the brunt of one of the largest non-nuclear blasts on record. The devastating blast 2 years ago was triggered when huge quantities of chemicals that had been negligently stored for years ignited at the port. Along the barrier that separates the highway from the port, 6:07 p.m. is painted in bold black font. It's the time the explosion happened. Photos of those who died in the blast are also fused onto the cement barrier, their faces dotted between paintings of buildings in Beirut that became lethal when walls collapsed, glass windows shattered, and bodies were thrown like rag dolls through the air by the force of the blast. In the port stands a twisted metal figure made from the wreckage of the port blast, the sculpture made by a local architect drew mixed reviews from locals, some who said that justice should come before memorials. Perhaps they'll prefer the iron sculpture of a judge's gavel with the words "Act for Justice" that stands in front of the port. The piece is a reminder that no one has been held accountable for the devastating blast that killed, maimed and traumatised so many. In fact, two of the politicians charged by the judge leading the inquiry into the port blast were re-elected in May. By the time I had finished my walk on Sunday and returned to my apartment nearby, part of the grain silos had collapsed. The normally busy street where I lived near the port was empty after people were warned to stay inside. They were also told to keep their air conditioning running all night in case there was any toxic substance in the air. Electricity at night is, of course, a luxury that few in Beirut have, as the country faces rolling blackouts and spiralling energy costs. The electricity in my building was turned off in the evening so that there would be enough power at night for air conditioning after the grain silos collapsed. A Beirut solution to a sadly Beirut problem. And while we all slept, the grain silos continued to burn, and the city prepared for the second anniversary of the port blast on Thursday. The sight of the burning grain silos 2 years after the port blast summed up many of the problems that Lebanon is facing, from hunger to corruption to political impunity. Some survivors wanted the silos preserved as a reminder of the explosion. They know all too well that Lebanon is a country where the ruling class has long acted with impunity. In June, the families of the victims filed lawsuits to overturn the government's plan to demolish the silos. Guida Frangia, a lawyer who helped draft one of the lawsuits, said that international law views the preservation of a crime site as part of the compensation for victims and a way to recognise the victims' pain and suffering. The Lebanese lawyer added that a failure to preserve the grain silos would not only affect the victims' mental health, but also their right to be treated with dignity. Aside from the symbolism, the grain silos also used to hold up to 100,000 tons of grain for emergencies. They could have helped Lebanon as it struggled with the spiralling cost of wheat due to the Ukraine war. The small Middle Eastern country relied on Russia and Ukraine for more than 70% of its wheat before the conflict locked Ukrainian grain in a war zone. After weeks of negotiations between the UN, Russia and Ukraine, a shipment of grain from the Ukrainian port of Odessa is finally due to arrive in Lebanon today on board the Razioni. The ship will leave its cargo at the port in the northern city of Tripoli rather than in Beirut though. Tripoli port is perhaps a safer destination for the important cargo, after two more silos collapsed at Beirut port on Thursday as crowds gathered to mark the second anniversary of the Porsche explosion. The concrete columns cracked and fell, sending a cloud of smoke into the sky as protesters covered their mouths in disbelief once again. For World Report in Beirut, I'm Hannah McCarthy.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, for myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.